Okay, go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, thanks. Okay, well, welcome everyone, and thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to talk. I'm going to speak for about 20, 25 minutes, and then I guess we'll have a discussion about this matter. Well, I think as Carol has introduced it, this year is the 100th anniversary of Northern Ireland, and there's some sort of celebrations planned. Funny, there's no exact date given, but it seems to be sometime over the summer. I'm sure we're all thrilled by this news, although I really have to say, I think this story is really flying under the radar. But clearly, COVID is dominating everything and every news item in every country. But I still think, even if it wasn't for COVID, would there really be too much interest in the rest of the UK, you know, in England, Wales, and Scotland about this anniversary? What struck me the first thing about it is that logically, if this is the 100th anniversary of Northern Ireland, it should be then the 100th anniversary of Southern Ireland or the Republic of Ireland. But there's absolutely no parallel ceremony planned down this side of the border. I should say I'm speaking from Cork, by the way, so I'm right at the very south of Ireland. I think traditionally the establishment in Dublin, they kind of use 1916 as the marking the beginnings or the foundation of the state here. It's a bit like, I suppose, the United States, where they use 1776 to celebrate their independence, even though, well, I think it wasn't until 1783 or around those dates before they actually became separate from Britain. Just it reminds me, speaking of the USA, I'm old enough, I can just about remember the Americans celebrating their bicentennial in 1976. And even though it was kind of after Watergate and Vietnam and America wasn't its usual ebullient self, there was still the usual parades and bands and flags prevalent. And some other event that this reminds me of, in 1989, I was in London. I was a kind of a recent party member at the time. And France was celebrating 200 years since the storming of the Bastille and the French Revolution. And I can still remember Mitterrand on the Champs-Élysées and the military parades and the fly pass and the fireworks. And it just got me thinking that in most countries, these kind of celebrations, so-called, they're something that the whole population is encouraged to kind of to get with and probably does get with it and to get on board with it and have a party about it. It's regarded as being a joyous thing. I mean, you'll always get, of course, the malcontents like the socialists who will be grumbling and criticizing. But you have to say probably these things are regarded. You know, sometimes we get a bank holiday and everybody's happy to whatever partake of them. But this won't happen in Northern Ireland, and it's nothing to do with COVID either. It's, you know, in Northern Ireland, you know, for well-known reasons, in some parts of Northern Ireland, there might be some activities this year, COVID permitting, of course, and whereas in other parts of Northern Ireland, I mean, nationalist parts of Northern Ireland, it's already certain that it's going to be met with indifference, if not hostility. I don't think it's helped by some of these, the celebrations of Northern Ireland have a decidedly unionist flavour. I think there's a campaign to get some statue to Lord Craigavon, who was the first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, put up. So it's not the kind of thing, I suppose, you're going to find too many Sinn Féin members getting behind. I should say, just before I get into the talk proper, I've written an article that I think will appear in the Standard in the next month or so on the same matter. Tonight, I'm giving more of an impersonal, informal talk. I'm certainly not giving the official party line on Northern Ireland. I'm not even sure if there is an official party line in Northern Ireland. So by all means, feel free to disagree or take issue with anything I say. Just going back to the start, as I said, Northern Ireland, it was set up in 1921 in contested circumstances, and I think it always had something of a troubled history. At the time, the big thing in British politics was still what was termed the Irish question, which had kind of dominated British politics, I guess, for the last few decades of the 19th century and into the first couple of decades of the 20th century. A bit like Europe has been a major factor in UK politics for the last 20 or 30 years. This is something I'm going to come back to because it's funny, the parallels with Europe or the issues of Europe are still in form, what you might term the Irish question. I'm not going to go into the history of Ireland in this talk because I think most people know Northern Ireland was set up because in that top northeast corner of Northern Ireland, the predominantly unionist, at the time it would have been synonymous with Protestant population, they wanted it to remain with the United Kingdom, whereas the rest of the population in the southern and western part of the country, who are mainly Catholic, they wanted their own country. At least some people did. That's in simple terms why Northern Ireland was set up. But it's funny, no one involved in setting it up, primarily the British government, but also the people in Northern Ireland and what became the regime down south, nobody regarded it as a satisfactory solution. No one was really happy with it entirely. I think it was accepted. It was always a bit of a stopgap measure. This Irish question had been around for a long time and impossible really to resolve. So the border was regarded as a bit of a makeshift a measure, you know, tied at least the British government over an awkward situation for a while until, you know, something turned up. I don't think it was ever intended, what is the border between the Northern Ireland and the Republic. It was never intended to be a full international frontier. Even when Ireland was partitioned, divided in 1921, the South, which is now the Republic of Ireland, was termed the Free State, and it had a dominion status. So the border between North and South was in some ways more of still an internal UK border. Not exactly the same as, but you know, maybe not too different either from the border between England and Scotland. It's an open border, but things are clearly done differently north and south of that border. Even the names were contested. I'm originally from Tipperary, so when I was growing up in the Republic, back in the 70s and 80s, it was still customarily for Northern Ireland to be referred to as the six counties. I think the view was Northern Ireland wasn't really a legitimate entity, and it was just a collection of six Irish counties that happened still to be controlled by Britain. And even the Unionist parties and leaders and general population, they weren't that happy with the term Northern Ireland either, because obviously it had the word Ireland in it. They always preferred, and still do to an extent, they preferred the word Ulster. I remember reading sometime just after World War II, when unionism was quite strong, Lord Brookra, who was the then Northern Ireland Prime Minister, he went over to Attlee to try and persuade him to change the name, actually, from the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ulster. But I think Attlee declined. I guess he was worried about sort of hostility from Dublin, which obviously would have been manageable, but maybe more importantly, you know, bad feeling with the United States over this matter. And even it's funny, if, I don't know if people over in Britain, if you see any political programs from Northern Ireland, what you'll always find is unionist representatives will insist on calling it Northern Ireland, and whereas Sinn Féin representatives call it the North of Ireland. And it's kind of silly in some ways the way they'll dogmatically stick to those terms throughout the duration of wherever they're talking about Northern Ireland. No, it's North of Ireland. Northern Ireland was set up in 1921, and whereas it always had a troubled history, at least it managed to stay afloat longer than a lot of doubters gave it. So it made it to 1971, where it had its 50th anniversary. And what's great about the internet is that you can see back in 1971 what the celebrations were like then. So it's an interesting comparison to what they're planned for now. It was called Ulster 71 was the name of it. And if you Google that or whatever, there's some great film in there about what was set up. Of course, we're looking at it back from 50 years further on again. And, in 1971, the troubles had started, but it was really only towards the end of 1971 that they really got serious in a major way. So it's kind of sad and almost poignant to look back in some of those the films that the government of Northern Ireland made in 1971. You know, they were talking about the great future that lay ahead of Northern Ireland. It was full of optimism. But when you look at it now, it looks like sort of a desperate promotional film for a firm that's about to go under. So it's kind of sad in some ways to see what happened there. And in fact, in 1971, in some ways, it really did mark the end of Northern Ireland, at least as was originally meant to be set up. I mean, originally the idea was it was going to be just like a part of Britain that happened to be on the island of Ireland, so that, you know, you'd go if a tourist came to Northern Ireland, they'd walk around and on all the civic buildings you'd see the Union flag flying, and you'd see a picture of the King or the Queen up on the walls, and that it was just basically meant to be a part of Britain, and unless it was the local accent, you couldn't really tell what part of the UK you were specifically in. I know for the first, I think, 20 or 30 years of Northern Ireland, under pressure from the local government there, the BBC didn't even mention that there was a minority there who weren't hugely happy about the very existence of the state. Anyway, after 1971, there was obviously more or less 25 years of the Troubles. And then following that, there's been this 25 years of the of an uneasy truce between what's termed the two sides, as set out in the Good Friday Agreement. Well, coming up to then to the bringing it up to more modern times, there's been four big changes, I think, in Northern Ireland over the last 100 years since it was set up. The first thing is demographically now it's more or less 50-50 between Protestants and Catholics. Originally, of course, it was set up and deliberately its borders were selected so that it would have a 2/3 Protestant, which would have been synonymous with Unionist, and a 1/3 Catholic, which would have been more or less all nationalist population. So it was, you know, the six counties were selected so that to give a safe Unionist electoral majority. That's no longer the case. In fact, I think in the medium term, there might be a small Catholic majority in Northern Ireland. Now, of course, a lot of Catholics are Unionists with a small U, so a Catholic majority in Northern Ireland doesn't automatically mean it's got to vote to reunite with the South. The second big change is in the economy. Northern Ireland traditionally was quite strong in manufacturing. And of course, over the last 100 years, the UK has moved from a manufacturing economy to being much more dominated by services and being a service economy now. So, you know, Northern Ireland 100 years ago would have, you know, I think everybody's aware of shipbuilding was very big there, but it had other important industries too, industries that were critically significant, I think, to the British state. That's no longer the case now. So, you know, does the ordinary man or the ordinary woman in the street in GB, are they that fussed whether Northern Ireland remains part of the UK? Or more importantly, are the capitalists in the UK, you know, are they willing really to pay a big cost to keep Northern Ireland in the UK? Is it regarded, you know, military and economically as significant as it was? Yeah, I think that's an open question. The third change is about Northern Ireland, I think, is the relative poverty there. I don't mean poverty in a sense of destitution, but I mean, in terms of the UK, I don't think Northern Ireland is the poorest part of the UK, but it's one of the poorer regions in the UK, certainly. And more significantly, is the position of Northern Ireland with respect relative to the Republic. I mean, for hundreds and hundreds of years, Northern Ireland was wealthier. It was the wealthiest part of Ireland. But that's flipped now in the last 30 years or so. And, you know, living standards are certainly lower in Northern Ireland than they are in the Republic. It's not always easy to be definite because the economies of both parts of Ireland are quite different. And down south, we have a lot of these multinationals, mostly American and involved in IT and finance and pharma and medical devices, and they can skew the economic GDP of the Republic quite a lot. I mean, a lot of it, of course, is just a racket that we have low corporation tax, so they're always trying to claim a huge amount of profits down here so that they don't have to pay as much tax as they would have in other jurisdictions. And I suppose the last big issue in terms of Northern Ireland, which has only happened really recently, is the rise of Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin, they're now the largest party in the Republic. They're not in government, but, you know, their trajectory is certainly upwards. And if we'll have a general election down here, probably in the next 2 or 3 years, and it's likely they'll win it. They won't form a majority because that's kind of difficult to do in the system down here. But it's quite likely that Mary Lou MacDonald, who's the Sinn Féin leader, will be the next Prime Minister Taoiseach of Ireland. And also, I think people might be aware, up in Northern Ireland, they have this kind of forced power-sharing arrangement. And the Deputy First Minister is Michelle O'Neill from Sinn Féin. But, you know, depending how the Unionist vote splits between Leavers and Remainers from the Brexit issue, it's possible she could become the First Minister of Northern Ireland. And then you'll have the Taoiseach in the Southern Ireland and the First Minister in Northern Ireland. They're both members of Sinn Féin. Now, Sinn Féin have had a kind of dodgy history, and politically they've tacked to the left and they've tacked to the right over the years. In the last 25 years, I think I suppose you'd characterise them as being a centre-left party in the political spectrum. Of course, as they get closer to government, they're keener and keener to give an image of being responsible and sensible. So obviously to push up their vote. But whatever their opportunistic sort of economic policies, there's one core idea they have, and that's the elimination of Northern Ireland. So the rise of Sinn Féin is, I think, self-evident, is not good news for the future of Northern Ireland. The single biggest thing, of course, that's made Northern Ireland put it back on the political agenda is undoubtedly Brexit. And then the subsidiary effect of the Brexit has on the position of Scotland within the Union. It's an understatement to say that Brexit has completely thrown the cat amongst the pigeons and really has driven a coach and horses through the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement. When the Good Friday Agreement was set up, which kind of ended the Troubles, it wasn't explicitly based on both countries being, Ireland and Britain being members of the European Union, but it made it much easier, obviously, especially because the border between the UK and the Republic of Ireland, of course, is the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and it was easy then to have a low key, uncontroversial border between the two states while they were both members of the EU. But now that obviously the UK has left the EU, that's obviously more of a challenge. I don't quite understand it, but the main unionist party in Northern Ireland, the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, I think I'm correct in saying they're the only Westminster-based party, i.e. the only party with representatives of Westminster who are actually in favour of Brexit. I mean, I think the Conservatives, I can't remember, were they neutral? They were divided, of course, but they might have been officially neutral. But all the other UK or Westminster parties, Labour and the Lib Dems and Plaid Cymru and the Greens and the Scottish Nationalists, they were all, I think, opposed to Brexit. So it does seem strange that the party in the part of the United Kingdom that would suffer, at least have more consequences for Brexit, were the only party who were supportive of it. And currently it's left us with this kind of controversial Northern Ireland protocol, which reminds me itself about the setting up of the border itself. Again, it's a short-term fix. Boris Johnson went for it clearly just so he could get his election, so that he subsequently won, of course. But that, does he really believe in it? I mean, with this internal markets bill that they introduced to Parliament a few months ago, it seemed to imply, and I'm sure he doesn't really believe in it, but he at the time he felt he had to sign up for it. But is he going to try and wriggle out for it? It strikes me, it was like the setting up of Northern Ireland itself. They had this intractable problem, how to complete Brexit. And the position of Northern Ireland was making it difficult. So Johnson probably thought, listen, I'll sign up to this. And then a few years down the line, maybe something might turn up and we might try and get out of it some way. Because it is kind of strange in the UK now that it must be one of the few countries in the world where a manufacturer in one part of the UK, in England or Wales, for instance, can export goods to Northern Ireland, which is still in the same country. So how long is that going to last? Probably, though, just as big as Brexit itself has been this thing of Brexit putting the wind in the sails of the Scottish Nationalists. And I mean, as far as I can tell, the polls seem to suggest that, there is a majority, I'm not exactly sure how big it is, of Scottish people now who would vote to leave the Union. Probably people are aware that it does matter a lot to Northern Ireland, because culturally, it's on both sides, whether they're nationalists or unionists, they've strong links to Scotland, more so than they do with Wales, say, or England itself. I mean, if you go into what are termed working class in any areas of any urban region of Northern Ireland, you tend to find the young guys and the girls too, I'm sure, more likely they're wearing either Rangers or Celtic strips. They're not wearing Man U or Chelsea strips. And of course, even the transport, links between Northern Ireland and GB, the important ones anyway, they all go through Scotland. In the last week or so, this kind of talk about the Boris Bridge or the Boris Tunnel between Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's obviously bullshit, of course, but it does show you that link is there. In passing, I know they won't go ahead with it, if they did go ahead with it, it would be the biggest waste of English taxpayers' money ever, because they'd be forking out for a piece of expensive infrastructure between two regions, Northern Ireland and Scotland, that could in a relatively short period of time not be separate countries. but that's by the by. I mean, more seriously, I think if Scotland did leave the Union, you know, would a union of England, Wales and Northern Ireland, would it be sustainable? You know, because to me, it throws up the whole thing of the relationship between English nationalism, Scottish nationalism and Northern Irish, Irish nationalism. That, and the whole idea of the Good Friday Agreement, of course, was couldn't solve those kind of things, but it could, you know, fudge them over or at least I'd hide them in a way that everybody could take something from it, smoothing out the corners, I guess I'm trying to say. I've only one last thing to talk about, and I'm kind of conscious so far in this talk, it's been talk about Northern Ireland, but it could have been given to any obviously group of people. But you know, we're all party members or party sympathisers, or and maybe people are interested in the party. So it's nice to kind of see, well, what's our view of this? What's the socialist angle on this? And this is where I'm really not sure myself. Just throw open some ideas. To me, what's interesting to me, it kind of shows the interaction between governments, the capitalist class, workers, and countries, and it provokes the question: what does drive the rise of nationalism in a particular area? Is it that there's an emerging local capitalist class who want to seal off markets or basically arrange things for their own profit? Or is it really intrinsic to do with the workers' cultural baggage that needs to be expressed and having a certain identity? I know some socialist theories might say, you know, countries are basically just rackets that are dreamt up by capitalists just so they can kind of arrange things to their own benefit. But in my view, in the long term, I could see capitalism actually probably be happier with having a one world system. You know, countries are expensive to maintain in terms of all the things that countries have. And if you're a big capitalist, you know, the idea of being able to locate your whatever your call centers or your factories anywhere in the world, getting workers from any part of the world to another part of the world, selling your goods or selling your services freely everywhere, I can see that being advantageous. So, you know, what is driving the existence or even promoting the development or formation of new countries? Which side of the class divide is behind that? I was probably one of these people very surprised that the Brexit referendum passed. My understanding from the socialist case is that we say, you know, it's the capitalist class drive the political dynamic of any country. And it's hard to see overall why Brexit suits the capitalist class. I know there's individual capitalists, that guy Tim Martin with his chain of pubs, and there's obviously going to be financiers in the City of London who would like much sort of low, light touch regulation, which they presume they'll get from a UK out of the EU. But it seemed to me, I'm no economist, so I'm no expert in this, that overall the capitalists as a whole would their interest of British capitalism was being in the EU. But clearly, if they were at the referendum, they were outvoted by the workers, and so Brexit happened. I mean, clearly countries come and countries go, and that's the way it's always been. And as socialists, we're always opposed, have always been opposed to countries, and we obviously continue to be opposed to countries wherever they exist or whoever's behind them. But, you know, in the next few years, you know, Northern Ireland celebrating its 100th anniversary, you know, will it make it to 120? Will it make it even to 110? Or will it celebrate its 200, its bicentennial in 100 years' time? Will the breakup of the UK, if that happens, if Scotland does leave the Union, if Northern Ireland does come into the Republic, you know, does that make it easier for us to promote the socialist message, or does it make it less easier? Is it kind of irrelevant, really? It doesn't make it either way. I mean, you imagine in England, will workers in England stop having a British identity and, you know, have an English identity? Will that make them more intrinsically right-wing or left-wing? Or, again, is there, from our point of view, you know, is there anything we could take from this, or in terms of what our message or, you know, should be? So I think I've spoken then for, I think, 20, 25 minutes. So I'm conscious not to bore everyone to death. So I'm not sure I'll stop now, and I'll just mute my microphone. And I guess it's over to Carla, I guess.